It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about an early 20th century Native American community in Wood County that was formed as an effort to preserve Native culture and traditions.
But first, it's our state news roundup. This week, labor and business took center stage as employees of Kohler Co. went on strike.
And Wisconsin politicians reacted to the possibility of Syrian refugees being settled in Wisconsin.
Joining us now to talk about those topics and more is Nora Hurdle, public issues reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Nora, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
Well, let's start with those labor issues and the Kohler strike. What is the main sticking point for workers here?
They are protesting a two-tier wage system in which they chose that a couple years ago, 5 years ago, when they were negotiating their last contract. So the newer employees there get paid $10 less per hour. I think that's averaging about $12.50 an hour, and they want to get rid of that. The company's final offer to them, which was released last week, they offered a 2% wage increase, bonuses, but the cost of health insurance are going to go up, and so people are worried that the wage increase and the bonuses wouldn't cover the difference on their health insurance.
What kind of impact has this had so far on Kohler and also on the surrounding community?
I think there were so many people that turned out on Monday that they clogged the street, and a judge issued an injunction to get them out of traffic on Tuesday. So they've been really visible. I read a story as well that honking cars through the night has affected people that were staying in a nearby hotel, and they changed hotels. Also, I think there's a holiday market that's beginning this week. It's still going on. But there's definitely a huge crowds of protesters, and not all of them are even with Kohler. Other unions are busing people in to show support for them.
Now, you mentioned that the 2% raise pay increase was not acceptable to the workers who are on strike. They're looking for more than that. Have they said exactly what they are looking for?
I'm not sure on that front. I know that the two-tier issue is a sticking point. I think 400 members of the union are at that lower pay level, which is, like I said, $10 less than some of their colleagues. So that's a big difference for the younger employees that are working there.
And as you watch this, what are you looking for a next step?
The protests are going to continue for the weekend. Some of the Facebook pages I saw for other unions are calling for people to travel to Sheboygan or just outside Sheboygan and show solidarity with them. So I suspect a couple more days of protests, but I haven't heard it or read anything yet about ongoing negotiations. So I assume that's coming.
We'll be watching that one. And so we'll look now at the Syrian refugee crisis and what's become a very controversial political issue here in the United States in the wake of the French terrorist attacks. What has the reaction been from state politicians?
This has been really interesting to watch because I don't think anyone expected the attacks last week, and then they've had such a ripple effect here. 30 or 31 governors, including our governor, have said that they wouldn't welcome Syrian refugees. I think a couple got turned away from Indiana and were welcomed in Connecticut instead on Wednesday this week. And there's questions about whether states can refuse refugees. And the U.S. lawmakers are considering it as well. So it's popping up all over the place. But I think there's still a lot of questions, too, about who has authority. Earlier this week, Governor Walker told the Obama administration that he's advised our state departments not to cooperate with efforts to bring Syrian refugees to the state.
And as far as you can tell, Nora, is this shaping up to be a partisan issue? At least here in Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, I'm not sure. I know House Speaker Robin Voss has spoken out against it. The state Democrats had a bill that they proposed right before the Paris attacks, but they've kind of they're not advocating for it loudly anymore. It would have encouraged the settlement of Syrian refugees here, so that's pretty much off the table. Nationally, the House passed a bill to intensify the requirements for Syrian refugees, and that did have some Democratic support, mostly Republican, but there's a fair number of people in the middle here, I think.
We're talking with Nora Hurdle right now, public issues reporter with the Wausau Daily Herald for our Wisconsin News Roundup. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court this week looked at the independence of the Department of Public Instruction and its superintendent. Now, in a nutshell, what is the Walker administration hoping to change about how the DPI does its work?
The Walker administration and the state legislature, they want to be able to review and have veto power of administrative rules in the State Department of Public Instruction. As it is now, because our state superintendent is elected on his own, he's got autonomy. Two courts have ruled that he has autonomy over those rules, and the Walker or the legislature can't veto those. But that's what's up for debate.
And what do we know about when we might expect a ruling?
It might not come until just before the summer. I think AP said all we know is that it'll be out before next summer.
And watching what we know so far, any indication about how things are looking?
Well, there was a decision in 1996 that secured the state superintendent's autonomy. At the time, Governor Tommy Thompson wanted to start a Department of Education that was under the governor's control, but the Supreme Court ruled that since the superintendent was elected by was elected independently, that he had that power. The state attorney general, Brad Schimmel, is asking the Supreme Court now to overturn that ruling. And it'll be really interesting to see how that turns out. Two of the justices, Ann Walsh Bradley and Shirley Abrahamson, were on the bench in 1996 and voted in that ruling, which was unanimous. But there's five conservative justices now, including David Prosser, who way back two decades ago was in the state assembly and had said, wrote a paper saying that he thought the legislature's power was greater than the schools. So it'll be interesting to see if there's a turnaround from the Supreme Court on the issue.
Nora, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Nora Hurdle, a public issues reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. She joined us for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
There's a 300-foot-tall bluff near the village of Arpin, Wisconsin, that rises above the country landscape of Wood County. In 1905, it was named Skunk Hill. At the height of its popularity, it was home to over 80 Native Americans who settled there in an effort to preserve and protect Native culture and traditions from U.S.-sanctioned suppression.
Robert Birmingham joins us now. He served as state archaeologist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and he teaches at UW-Waukesha. His new book is called Skunk Hill, a Native Ceremonial Community in Wisconsin. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you have been studying this this community at Skunk Hill for a long time. I think I read 30 years. What was so interesting and fascinating to you about that?
Well, actually, the phenomenon that I was studying was off-reservation Indian communities. That is, are Native people who were living in places, often in very remote places, right into the 20th century, in order so that they could pursue traditional ways and traditional religious beliefs without interference of the United States. So I had, many years ago, studied a few of these communities, and starting about year 2000, began work with Native people, county officials, and others on this community of Skunk Hill, because it is currently a part of a county park. And controversy started to erupt over appropriate land use on an area that local Native people thought was sacred, and of course had several cemeteries and so on. So as a part of that controversy, I and my office at the State Archaeologist Office, State Historical Society, went up and began to gather information about the community. And it was a part of this story, a broader story, that was so interesting and so relevant, I think, today, that I turned it into a book.
Well, let's talk about that location. It's in Wood County. You said it's the site of a county park today. Why did that particular location, Skunk Hill, become the site of this off-reservation community?
Well, it goes back to the 19th century, and this is a small mountain. It's a mountain that's mostly rocky. In fact, it's not a very good place to live at all. But it had significance to people who were living in the area, for example, the Potawatomi, who lived in the area. They lived in the area because they had been refused to be removed to a Western reservation. And they held it in significance and, in fact, probably started calling it Skunk Hill a long time ago. And then it was logged over by lumbering interests. In around 1900, it was still being referred to as Bald Mountain. So it wasn't very good for anything for other people. But in 1905, a number of Native people, Potawatomi, from the Kansas Reservation, actually purchased the land so they could move there and pursue traditional ways, and especially a spiritual movement, a rather new spiritual movement called the Dream Dance. Traditional ways, ceremonies, speaking of Native language had all been ruled illegal for reservations. So these folks, between 80 and 100, came to Wisconsin, took a train. Trains ended up at this place that they had purchased and formed a community that was based around the practice of this dream dance, but also other traditional ceremonies.
Now, before we get into the dream dance, I guess it's also called the drum dance, I want to talk a little bit about the context historically. So what was going on between the United States and Native Americans at this time, just to set us up on what the relationships were like.
Yeah, the relationship between Native peoples, indigenous nations, and so on in the United States changed considerably through time. And for a time, the United States made treaties with Native people. The Natives would give up certain lands, and they would be given compensation, monies, and so on. About 1830, or exactly in 1830, a new policy began that sought to remove all Native people from east of the Mississippi River and send them to reservations. These were coerced treaties and so on. And a number of people here in Wisconsin refused to leave. Among them the Ho-Chunk, Wisconsin Ho-Chunk today, and Potawatomi. Now, beginning in the 1870s, American policy again changed, and the idea was to do away with reservations altogether. And some very well-meaning people, and people we would call liberals today, even back this, saying it's better for the Native people if they are absorbed in the broader dominant culture. And so a number of policies were set up to force Natives into the dominant culture. Reservations were carved up into individual plots, and the individual Native people were expected to become farmers and ranchers and so on and become very productive and sort of the, you know, Judeo-Christian value system. And but religious ceremonies were forbidden. Speaking the language on reservations was forbidden. Children were taken from their parents and sent to to boarding schools to learn white ways and menial tasks. And so a great deal of oppression occurred. And then, however, in that context, we see a number of nativistic movements arise among Native people. And one of these was called the Dream Dance originally, and it sought to return people to traditional ways, but also had a new message. And because of all the conflicts between Natives themselves and the whites, it emphasized peaceful accommodation between peoples.
And we're going to find out more about what that is in just a moment as we talk right now with Robert Birmingham. He's the author of the new book, Skunk Hill, A Native Ceremonial Community in Wisconsin. Skunk Hill is in Wood County. And we're talking about this dream dance, and this has quite a history and a story behind it, and also there's the role of what it meant in the community. But let's start with 101. What was the dream dance?
Well, again, it was what anthropologists refer to generally as a cultural revitalization movement. When cultures throughout the world are under certain kinds of repression, oftentimes a messiah-like figure will arise and say, we need to do this in order to get back to who we are. But often new messages would be introduced here. And among the oral histories of many Native peoples, a young woman called a Tail Feather Woman was a Sioux girl or a woman who, after attack on her village, crawled out into the weeds and after some days had basically the Great Spirit talk to her and said, you are to go and to make a big drum, a huge drum. Most drums at the time were small hand drums. But her message was, no, we Native people should drum together. And so it introduced what is often referred to today as the powwow drum, and very familiar in powwows, you know, throughout the nation. But large drums, but they are to be beaten together. And she also gave ceremonies, specific ceremonies that should be conducted, and also a code of life, rejecting vices, many of them introduced by whites, of course, but other, you know, things like adultery and drinking and so on, these were forbidden, to live a righteous life, but one dedicated to peace. And this ceremony was really, the dream dance ceremony was that. It's also called a drum dance. It was not just a dance, it's a way of life, but there are a number of ceremonies, seasonal ceremonies, that attended to it. And it's still survives today, and it's called the Big Drum.
So this way of life, the drum dance way of life, was it the corner, or I should say the center, rather,
yes,
of this community? That's what this was all about, living this lifestyle.
Yeah, like I said, it was this Powers Bluff, where the community is located, is not a very good place to live. I mean, there's the only water are a few springs in the area. It's not on a lake or a river. At the time, it was occupied. It was surrounded mostly by farms. So there were no real good hunting and so on. So the community was established specifically as a religious community, a ceremonial community, rather than one that was simply a good place to live.
How unusual was that at the time?
The Skunk Hill was actually predated by several other ceremonial communities, all founded by an individual named John Young, who was a disciple of this spiritual movement. And he, in fact, had a number of communities. They had to change location constantly because of white settlement pressure and so on. So there were other communities like it, and they were all dedicated, again, to the dream dance or the big drum.
So what happened to this community?
It dissipated after a time, and there are a number of reasons for that. One is towards the end of the 1920s and early 30s, pressure was taken off Native people on reservations. The United States government had realized that this whole all these programs had been a total disaster, only accelerated the poverty and misery of Native people. And so ultimately in 1834, under the Roosevelt administration, All of these policies were thrown out the window. Reservations are restored. So in one respect, these special communities weren't needed as much before. But also, again, this is a tough place to live. People moved on to find jobs. Certainly the Great Depression didn't help, but we saw people moving there. I mean, people were living there until the in 1950s, 1960s, there were still people there. And the descendants of Skunk Hill still live in the general area.
Such an interesting story. Thank you so much for sharing it today.
You bet.
We've been talking to Robert Birmingham, author of the book Skunk Hill, a Native Ceremonial Community in Wisconsin. Robert Birmingham is a professor at UW-Waukesha.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
New data from the Pew Research Center shows how working parents share parenting and household responsibilities. The number of two-parent households where both parents are working full-time has risen sharply since the 1970s. That shift means family life is changing here in the United States.
Pew released their survey earlier this month, and results show that over half of working parents say it's difficult to balance parenting and working. And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Does your family have two working parents? Do you struggle being a parent and working full or maybe part-time? What is your experience like? Call in now at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stephanie Kuntz is with us now to look at this new survey. She's a professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College and director of research and public education for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think we all probably have noticed this long-term trend, more families with two employed parents, maybe full-time parents. But to set the scene for us, how long has this change been going on, and has it been a steady growth or fits and starts?
Well, it's been a pretty steady growth. If you go back to 1960, almost half of mothers were full-time mothers, and there was really only a tiny percentage of young kids who had women who worked. And today, of course, 70% of kids have every parent in the household involved in the labor force. Women's now dual earner families, like you said, are the vast majority of families, even though it's true that mothers of young children tend to work part-time, the majority of them work full-time as well. So it's been a huge change. There have been a few ups and downs. Every once in a while, somebody announces that, oh, moms are quitting the workforce, but it always turns out to simply be some sort of dip in the employment that is equally distributed among people who are not parents as well.
This is a big change, and there have been growing pains. We haven't settled into a new normal, have we, on this?
No. We invented all of our work policies and social policies in the 1950s, this aberrant time when when the largest number of kids ever were being raised by a stay-at-home mom and a full-time working father who could count on keeping his job in a way that people can't today. Our unemployment policies, everything are worked around that, and our emotional expectations of family lives. This was also a period in the 60s when women were told that they were exclusively responsible for kids. They were the only experts in it. That a man, this is a direct quote from a sociologist of the 1960s, that a man who liked to change diapers or play with his kids or give his kid a bottle might be suspected of having a little too much fat on the inner thigh. So there was this contempt for male involvement at home and for women involvement in the workplace that still hangs over our heads, gives us expectations, and then even as our expectations and desires change, we run into the wall that the United States is the most backward country in the developed world in terms of the policies that it has to help parents combine work and family and fit them together in a reasonable way.
We'll get more into those policies in just a few, but this new survey shows over half of working parents, these two-employed parents, say they're struggling with balancing home and work life. Talk us through how they're being stretched here.
Well, they're being stretched in a number of ways. And by the way, U.S. parents report greater stresses, both males and females, and greater levels of work-family conflict than any other country in the Western world. And that has to do, I think, with these terrible policies that we have. But we're being stretched. People in low-income jobs are stretched because they have no predictability. They have much too much flexibility in their work. Their work hours may be changed, which makes it impossible
flexible for the employer, not the
yes,
flexible
exactly.
for the employer, not the employee.
Exactly.
You're saying, I get it.
And then you get at, in the higher income, the high professionals, we have this weird change that's occurred. It used to be that the best jobs were the ones, we called them banker's hours, when you had more flexibility in time, you didn't have so many work hours, but it's the highest paid workers who engage in overwork, who are more likely to work more than 50 hours a week, which makes it almost impossible to juggle work and family with two people in the workforce. And so parents are trying to come to terms with the fact that we don't have these policies, and there's lots of other ones. We don't have affordable, quality child care. The schools differ, so parents have to worry about where they go to school. None of these problems are true in the developed Western nations or the Nordic nations, and that really decreases parental stress. And then, of course, we're such an individualistic nation that instead of recognizing that this is not the fault of our partner or our community, but of the social policies that we have, we also, I think, then tend to turn on each other to ask, are you doing enough? Are you doing enough? What's going on there? And so that ratchets the stress up even more.
So we treat it more as maybe a time management, a self-help kind of problem.
That's right. As though if we had 50 hours in the day or 80 hours, you know, we could somehow manage this. Now, I think parents are actually doing the best they can. There are a few things that stand in the way of evenness. But on the whole, there's just been extraordinary progress on the part of men and women in terms of coming to terms with these new ideas. But there, the policies prevent men from gaining the experience they need at home because we do not have the kind of policies that encourage parental leave and paternal involvement, which is what teaches men to take full involvement in the home. And, of course, those same that lack of policies force women to take time off, which reinforces their secondary status in the workplace, but their primary status at home, so that they tend to be, even when the work itself is shared, they tend to still be the supervisors, the managers, and that's an awful stress on them that they often resent.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Evergreen State College, looking at family life and family stress in the era of two breadwinners. Both parents employed stretches families pretty thin. Now, Stephanie, you mentioned the idea that the 50s were the aberration. That was the weird time. A lot of times people seem to talk about the 50s as, in some ways, the good old days, the normal times that we've strayed from. Do you think that attitude is maybe one of the things keeping us from making policies that match our current reality?
Yes, and I think particularly our politicians and policymakers and the CEOs of most companies who come from that era and who are most likely to have the leftover family forms from that era have really had a hard time catching up. But in fact, it was a total fluke. Through most of history, you know, there was no such thing as a male breadwinner. Women and men, in colonial days, wives were called yoke mates because they were expected to work right alongside their husbands. Up until the 1920s and 30s, most families depended either on the labor of wives or on their children's labor. It wasn't until the 1950s that a really large number of small children were brought up in homes where the woman was available to take care of them and the men were not. Now, the gender ideologies that produced that, that made women either happy to do it or just forced to do it because they couldn't get jobs and they were so there was so much prejudice against them, and the work policies that made it possible for men to support a family on one income, and the work securities, those are all gone, and yet we haven't caught up with this as a system, even though I think on the ground we've seen extremely extraordinary change. Men have tripled the amount of child care they do, doubled the amount of housework. Women now say that having a man who shares bread, work, and chores is not only one of the highest predictors of marital satisfaction, but one of the highest predictors of their sexual attraction to him. So we all want this stuff, but it's just hard to put it into action in our current system.
And staying with the idea of those modern-day yoke mates and how they split the work in the household, you and others have written that while men are doing more housework, maybe women are doing a little less still, women are doing a lot more than men. There used to be a notion that it's a matter of lazy men not wanting to do this stuff. You say it's a little more complicated than that.
I think it's much more complicated than that. You know, first of all, this idea that there's a second shift that women do in the home has just been disproven by time diaries. It is true that women do more housework, but the most of this and childcare, but most of that unevenness occurs in the early years of infancy. When we look together at men and women with children and we add up the paid work hours, men still tend to go to work and more hours after a baby comes, women tend to cut back. So when we look at the overall load of paid and unpaid work, it's fairly even, except in those infant years. There's still a couple of things that are uneven about it. And as I say, come back to the fact that we have such lousy work family policies. Because somebody generally has to stay home, and it's more likely to be the woman for long periods of time, she becomes the expert. And this affects their relationship in both sides. The man, even if he wants to help, isn't quite sure what to do. Just as when we women entered the workforce, we're a little hesitant about how to become supervisors and managers, and we would ask for advice. Well, that's how men are in the home when they haven't had paternity leave, and we know from the experience of other countries that did institute paternity leave that it totally changes these dynamics. Men become much more confident about their ability to do housework, to do childcare, and they keep doing it after they go back to work. And in fact, a conflict over housework and childcare really declines in those homes where men have taken extended paternity leaves. But in the meantime, women are home. They've been taking these kind of leaves. It hurts them in the long run in the workforce. It holds back their participation and their financial accumulation and their promotions. But it also reinforces a certain thing that sometimes we women have to look out for. And that is the sense that, yes, well, we are the experts. So we'll tend to, sociologists call it gatekeeping. We'll say to the guy, well, that's not the way you do it. And of course, that doesn't really help encourage him to take that responsibility.
We're talking to Stephanie Kuntz from the Council on Contemporary Families about new data from the Pew Research Center on working parents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you stretched thin at home, balancing work life and home life as a parent? How do you and your partner split up the household responsibilities? What would help you policy-wise at your business, government, or help from your family? 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Take your calls after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephanie Kuntz about a new survey from the Pew Research Center on how working parents balance having children, having a household, and having a job. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, thoughts, experiences. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We will go right to our callers now. Dean is on the line in La Crosse. Dean, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Oh, well, I was just interested in this topic because my fiance and I are new parents. We have a 3-month-old boy, and we're definitely trying to switch things up and come up with creative ideas to be able to, keep the workload even and, make our money stretch. So, it's definitely been a struggle, but we're loving every minute of it.
So what kind of congratulations, first of all, but how are you getting creative there?
So my fiance actually just came up with the idea, one of us are going to switch our job to a third shift in order to try to eliminate our daycare costs, which is quite pricey.
Dean, thank you so much for sharing that. Good luck to you. Stephanie, getting creative there. You could see downsides. Maybe they're not going to see each other that much in those early years.
Well, that is a downside. I mean, the upside is that it gives him the hands-on experience that a lot of fathers don't get. But But it's also important, you know, like they say on the planes, you know, put your oxygen mask on yourself first. Your relationship also counts. So they're going to have to pay a lot of attention to that. But, you know, this is one, what he raises shows us why. There's not just one policy. We often talk about this as a woman's issue, and I think that we're clear now that it's increasingly not just a woman's issue. It's a caregiver's issue, not just parents. A lot of people have older relatives they're caring for, too. But we also talk about as though there's one policy that will solve it, like paid maternity leave or paid paternity leave, both, and I think they have to be, both parents have to take them. They can't transfer them to the other. But you also need a whole package of policies. You need affordable, quality child care so people don't have to disrupt their lives that way and their sleep patterns and their relationship. And you also need another thing that America doesn't have that every European country has, and that is paid vacation and sick days. We do not have those guaranteed, but that's what parents need after the newborn time to take care of short-term emergencies or short-term kinds of opportunities, even, to be with your kids. So we really need a package of care policies, and other countries have them, and other countries are thriving. There's no reason we can't.
Dean, thanks for the call, and good luck. We'll go next to Andrew in St. Paul, Minnesota. Andrew, hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. Yes. Are you there?
Go ahead, Andrew.
Sorry about that. Recently engaged, been engaged since Valentine's Day, and my fiance's a dentist, and I'm a high school teacher. And I know we, you know, haven't started the family yet or anything, but there was some struggles early on, especially because I, you know, being a guy, sort of seemed like I was assuming more of the traditional female role, while her being the major breadwinner, assuming more of the, you know, male roles in the relationship. So, you know, me being kind of a traditional guy kind of threw me off. But over time, you know, for me, it's, you know, I had to accept, as well as, you know, get that confidence that this is the woman I love and this is the woman I want to be with. And it really, at the end of the day, doesn't matter. And I think very often you got to have that solid foundation of love, trust, and respect, mutual respect. And really, you know, if you can be compatible, then it can work.
Andrew, thanks a lot for that call. I want to bring Stephanie on this. I mean, this is fodder for many a sitcom, right? The wife has the major breadwinner role. Oh, what a complicated thing this is. This is not all that weird at this point in time, is it, Stephanie?
It is not weird. And one of the things that men are gradually discovering, we find that some men still are threatened by this, and the ones most likely to be are the ones who have this narrow identity of themselves as a male breadwinner and a very materialistic kind of idea of what it means to be successful. So when they're not earning more than the guy, than the woman is, it hurts their pride, and it actually hurts their health. And sometimes women tend to try to overcompensate for it, you know, make up for it. What your caller said is exactly right. You've got to hit it head on and recognize that there are delights to be found in being more flexible about your roles. Women need to learn that, you know, men are good for other things than just, you know, scaring the mouse away. And actually, we can set mouse traps ourselves. And women and men both need to learn that this sharing tends to be very, very satisfying in relationships. And in fact, I can tell you one set of wonderfully encouraging, let us say inspiring, the most young couples it should be. In marriages and relationships formed since the early 1990s, researchers have found with now four or five different studies that couples who share housework and childcare equally report the highest marital satisfaction, the most sexual satisfaction, and, get this, the most frequent sex. So there's some relationship benefits to doing this.
All right, well, that's a good place to leave it. Stephanie, thanks. As always, good to talk to you again.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob.
We've been talking to Stephanie Kuntz, Professor of History and Family Studies at the Evergreen State College. She's also Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. She's with us to talk about a new survey from the Pew Research Center about how working parents balance having children and having a job. By the way, you can keep sharing your stories, your thoughts, observations, maybe solutions to some of the problems we've been talking about. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page. I think we've got a discussion started up there now. If you have a quick note, though, as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. thousands of people are expected at Milwaukee's lakefront tomorrow for the commissioning of the USS Milwaukee. The Navy says the ship, built in Marinette, a namesake of Milwaukee, will soon head across the globe. That deployment comes at a time of increased threats of terrorism and other potential risks. Some analysts continue to question whether the ship's design and performance are up to the task of modern combat needs. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The USS Milwaukee is what's known as a littoral combat ship, or LCS. It's a type the Navy only began using a few years ago. Navigator Alexander Gallagher stands on the bridge and explains how the LCS is different.
Basically, what it can do is walk sideways without the use of tugs. And it can corner much faster, and it can get into shallower areas than other ships can. There's no screws or rudders on the bottom of the ship to be damaged.
Instead, water jets drive this $400 million vessel with the power coming from natural gas and diesel engines. Also special about the LCS, the Navy says the USS Milwaukee can switch into different types of combat mode more quickly. Inside the ship, near the back or stern, Commander Kendall Bridgewater explains how different combat equipment, such as anti-mine or submarine gear, or remotely operated craft, will be loaded onto the Milwaukee.
The way we load these mission packages on board the ship is through this hatch over our head. This is called the bolted equipment removable patch, okay? So as we come ashore, we would need to change out a mission module. We'd have a shore-based crane lift off this hatch, and then we'd drop these modules in.
Bridgewater calls the modular weapons system a plug-and-play concept, but the modular design has problems, according to Eric Wertheim. He's author and editor of the Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets of the World. While Wertheim says the LCS has many strengths, there have been logistical concerns.
So, for instance, let's say you're doing warfare hunting submarines, and then they say, wait a second, our big problem now is mines. Now you got to go back to your port, swap the module, swap part of the crew, and then come back out and do the mission. Many argue, understandably so, that a larger ship that's multi-mission does not need to swap those modules, does not need to swap its crew.
Wertheim says the other main concern has been whether the LCS has enough firepower to go up against vessels from larger nations like Russia or China, that to some are bigger threats than they were a decade ago when the LCS project began. The defense contractor for the USS Milwaukee, Lockheed Martin, says changes are coming to the LCS. Company Vice President Joe North says stay tuned.
Industry hasn't seen those specifications yet. They're still working them inside the Navy. But that, quote, frigate variant of LCS will have those new requirements that they're looking for, but the current designs meet everything that the Navy asked for.
North also says the modular weapons systems are already on two LCS that are deployed in Southeast Asia, and that testing for another mission package is on schedule. Commander Bridgewater of the USS Milwaukee says he knew the criticisms of the LCS ships early on, but defends the program.
The shipbuilding process is a lengthy process. Normally you're talking 20 years from conception to putting in the water. We did it in less than half that time.
The projected life of the USS Milwaukee is about 25 years. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow's commissioning ceremony for the ship begins at 1 p.m., though tickets are no longer available. For photos of the USS Milwaukee, go to WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. News is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.